You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brenna Hicks, the kid counselor. This is the Play Therapy Podcast, where you get a masterclass in child-centered play therapy and practical support and application for your work with children and their families. In today's episode, I am answering a question from Julia in California. So Julia, thanks so much for reaching out. She actually has a group of related questions. So the overarching theme of the email was, what do you do when the child's progress doesn't seem to fit the standard model or time frame? So I'm kind of summarizing on her behalf. There were quite a few questions and I'll answer all of those. But it's essentially, what happens when the stages and the phases and the timeline and the progress that we expect to see doesn't go in the way that it traditionally does across standard cases? So let me read most of what she asked about in the email, and then we'll dive in. So she said, "Hi, Brenna, I'm loving your podcast. I have a question for you. With child-centered play, what if the child doesn't move into the work phase or engage in any aggressive themes? I had a client I worked with for 9 months using non-directive play who had an intellectual disability and a history of trauma. She led our play, and I saw her confidence and engagement grow. She did slime, art, playing games, etc. But at home and in school, there were more troubling behaviors. I always wondered if any themes of aggression or violence or other behaviors would come out in the therapy room, but they did not, as even her art was very colorful, while at home she was very dark. Do some clients have the reverse effect in child-centered play therapy, where therapy is the safe place, and so they explore more of their playful side only, and then outside of therapy is where behaviors show up? Are they still making progress if we don't see any resistance or aggression? How do we help them bridge therapy to the outside world so that parents and teachers see improvement, since they are the ones bringing the kids to therapy and often are at their wits' end? Do we just tell them to wait and hope it will get better on its own? How do you coach them on what to do when behaviors are getting worse? Is there any place to model or teach coping skills? And if not, can you explain more?" And then said, "I'm still learning and connecting the dots, so I realize that I might be misunderstanding this phase of the process." So Julia, thank you so much for reaching out. And obviously a lot of related questions in that email, so I'm going to unpack those as best I can. So how I think this will probably tease out in this episode, just to kind of give you a little preface, is you mentioned, Julia, in your email, the work phase. What if the child doesn't move into the work phase? I think that's actually not what's going on here. So we're going to talk about what the work phase actually looks like. And obviously that sometimes behaviors get worse before they get better. Once kids start therapy, that's a relevant point to answer some of your questions. And what the function of the playroom is in the child-centered model. I think that will also address some of your concerns. And then the importance of the articulation process. So we will unpack those four things together, and hopefully that will help all of us understand how to handle when a child doesn't seem to be meeting the standard process or movement or timeline or something like that. All right, so Julia, your first question is, what if the child doesn't move into the work phase or engage in any aggressive themes? So those are actually two separate questions, and I'll address each. So the first is, what if they don't engage in any aggressive themes? So if you've listened to the curriculum episodes of the Play Therapy Podcast, obviously I've been diving into the themes and each one has been specific. So we did talk about aggression, and there are kids that do not necessarily play out aggressively. In other words, they're not creating battles, they're not fighting, they're not arguing, they're not hitting things. So yes, of course, there are always going to be kids that do not engage in aggression. However, when we look at these stages and phases, we understand that by default and by the natural trajectory of the child-centered model, kids do move from aggression to regression. So inevitably, you do have kids that will work through aggression, even if it is not aggressive play. And I know that's kind of complicated, and for time's sake and to address all these questions, I might save that for a later episode. But there are definitely behaviors. They don't always show up in the playroom either. So that's another distinct and separate issue. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Maybe her behavior at school and at home is where her aggression was coming out. Because you may not necessarily see aggressive themes in the playroom, but that doesn't mean the child is not working through their aggression. So I don't have a whole lot of detail on what was going on at home and in school. You just indicated, quote, troubling behaviors. But I should assume, I think, that that probably means some of that aggression was manifesting itself outside of the playroom. So keep in mind, when we're looking at phases and stages, there is a movement through the aggression, but it does not necessarily mean that you will see aggression in the playroom. So I wanted to make sure that was clear. But now let's dive into what you said, what if the child doesn't move into the work phase? So I think it's very important to make it abundantly clear that anytime we see a child changing, anytime we see them gaining skills, every time we see growth in the playroom, anytime we see the acquisition of the four universal outcomes of the child-centered model. And if you have no idea what the four universal outcomes are, please go back and start at episode one and listen in order. But as a brief recap, I'm going to let you all shout it out to me. What are the four universal outcomes? Yes, I'm sure all of you remembered. So they are increased self-esteem, increased worldview, increased regulation, and increased emotional vocabulary. So if we see the acquisition of any of those four universal outcomes, if we see growth, if we see change, if we see any kind of new skill use, and it, Julia, it sounds like you did. You said, I saw her confidence grow. I saw her engagement grow. She did slime. She did art. She played games. So in that case, she was 100% in the work phase. So I don't want us to get caught up in, we have to see this marker so that we know that all of a sudden now the child is in the work phase. The work phase is a broad category of when kids are working through their junk and when we start to see healing and growth and positive change. So in your case, Julia, she was in the work phase, even though you never saw any aggression previous to getting to that stage. So what do we do when we see behaviors increasing or getting worse, either in the playroom or at home or at school or in any other environment? This is actually very common. This is why, and I'm actually kind of skipping ahead to my third point, but this is why, fourth point, I lied. This is why the articulation piece of communicating with parents and teachers and school staff and, you know, whomever the child interacts with about the play therapy process, that's why it's so important. Because I would say eight and a half out of 10 kids, behaviors get worse before they get better once they start the child-centered play therapy process. So understanding that, setting that as an expectation, preparing people for that, that is a big piece of this. And here's why. Because often we think that therapy as a whole, but specifically child-centered play therapy, if you think of an XY axis, I typically draw this for parents in consultations, so you're going to have to envision my drawing that I'm air drawing right now. But you have an X and Y axis, right? And so where the axes meet, that is like 0.0, 0. You remember when you had to graph things in middle school? So 0, 0 is right where the X and the Y axes meet. Well, we often think of therapy, but specifically therapy with kids, that we're starting at 0, 0 and we're moving up and right in a straight linear direction. So we may finish at, you know, 8, 8 or whatever up and right we stop at on the graph, right? So we move over 8 to the right and up 8 higher. So we're at 8, 8. Well, that's lovely in theory, but therapy doesn't work that way. So essentially what we're doing is we are always moving in an up and right direction. We are always getting to that up and right point, but it is a loop-de-loop and a swirl and a backslide and some zigzags and some curly cues and all kinds of other craziness. And when kids start therapy, it forces them to deal with emotions that they've not dealt with. It forces them to deal with their struggles that they've not had to face. It forces them to bring up issues that they've been trying to repress or ignore. If you've ever been in therapy yourself, you know how hard it is to deal with your own junk. And when you're walking through the muck of everything you're dealing with, it's pretty awful. So, and related aside, if you have never been in therapy yourself, you should never sit in the chair of the therapist before you've sat in the chair of a client. So that's just public service announcement. So please be aware that your own work comes first. And you need to know what it feels like to be a client. You need to know what it feels like to deal with your junk. You need to know what it feels like to have a therapist guide you. That will actually make you a much better therapist. So if you have not been in therapy yourself, even if you say, you know what, I don't really think I need therapy, you do. You just don't know it. And we all benefit from therapy. If we don't believe in the foundational principles of becoming the best version of ourselves that we can be with some help, then this all kind of falls apart, right? So Rogers says that our three core conditions need to be met for us to self-actualize, and that happens in therapy. So there was your bonus for today. But I'll get back on track now. So when you have been in therapy, if you have, you know how hard it is. So therefore, when a child starts therapy, it usually causes dysregulation. It usually causes more upheaval. I mean, not that they were really stable and calm and grounded before therapy began, probably not, or they wouldn't have started therapy in the first place, right? But it makes everything worse because now they're emotional and they're volatile and they're cranky and they're, you know, hanging on by a thread. And so everything sets them over the edge. So therefore, we have to be aware that behavior usually gets worse before it gets better. That is a normal part of the process. So the fact that you were seeing a lot of growth and positive things in the playroom, but that there were behaviors outside of the playroom that were getting worse, that is normal, expected, and something that we should be prepared for, as well as we should prepare all the adults in the child's life for. So that's my thought on that. Third, when we're talking about the playroom. So Julia, your question was, do some clients have the reverse effect where therapy is the safe place and so they explore more of their playful side only, but then outside of therapy is where the behaviors show up? So I understand what you're asking there, and I think to a degree that is accurate, but I'm going to tweak that a little bit. Because essentially what's going on is the playroom and the relationship with you. So you can't have one without the other, because a playroom in a school where a child goes in and plays by themselves is not therapeutically valuable. And the relationship with a child, a teacher can have a relationship with a child, but without the context of play therapy and the child-centered model, that also loses its effectiveness. So you have to have both, right? So you have the playroom and the therapeutic relationship with the therapist. But when you have both of those together, when the child comes to the playroom with you, that is their safe space. So to answer your question, yes, of course, the playroom is the safe space. However, it is not that they explore their playful side only and then outside of therapy is where the behaviors show up. It is more that the playroom becomes the balance for their other environments. What I mean by that is, we talk a lot about a pendulum, right? So when a child feels that their pendulum has been stuck on powerlessness and lack of control, in the playroom, they swing the pendulum to the other side and they get stuck with dictatorial authority and absolute power and control before they find center. So in this case, it seems as though when she was in the playroom with you, she was able to find the counterbalance to what was her norm outside. So if her norm outside was troubling behaviors, dark, angry, aggressive, whatever, you didn't really elaborate on what those behaviors were. But keep in mind, no child wants to be stuck on either end of the spectrum. Neither end of the pendulum is healthy. So if she's stuck in all of this maladaptive coping, she comes into the playroom, she's probably going to swing all the way to the other side and explore her playfulness and her color and her happiness and her art and her creativity and her slime making. Why? Because she's not able to do that in any other environment. There are preconceived notions and expectations about her behavior with mom and dad and siblings and teacher and school and wherever else she may go. But with you, there's the freedom to say, I hate being stuck over here. Let me see what it's like to come to the other side. So I actually think that when they are in that safe space with that safe person, it affords them the opportunity to practice what it feels like to change. What does it feel like to paint art that's colorful and happy? What does it feel like to laugh and smile while I play a game? What does it feel like to be creative and imaginative and make slime? She's probably not going to get those opportunities anywhere else with anyone else. So that's practice ground for her so that later she can know what it feels like and implement it in other environments. And then finally, how do we help them bridge therapy to the outside world so that parents and teachers see improvement since they're the ones bringing kids to therapy and are often at their wits' end? Do we just tell them to wait and hope it will get better on its own? How do you coach them on what to do when behaviors are getting worse? So all of those questions can be summed up in one word, articulation. And that's one of the things we spend a very, very large chunk of weeks in the training program that I have, the six-figure play therapist training program. We spend so much time on articulation for a reason, because we have to be the person that communicates the process. We have to be the person that communicates expectations. We have to be the person that provides psychoeducation. We have to be the person that is teaching skills to teachers and parents and whomever interacts with the child on a daily basis, because this is not just about the hour of child-centered play therapy each week in the playroom. This is about all of the adults in the child's world, and they need to be fully invested and bought in and committed. And they understand the process. They know what to expect. That falls on us. So articulation is crucial. So we help them understand what the four phases are. We help them understand what the four stages are. We help them understand what they can expect, that resistance often means that kids fight coming to therapy. Typically, behavior gets worse before it gets better. You need to be prepared for that. Typically, kids will change in one environment first, but not the other. So they practice in one environment before they extend it to new environments. It's like dipping toe in the water to see if it's cold or too hot or whatever. So the idea is the articulation process is what saves the frustration and the waiting game and the intolerance for waiting until the child can work through their things. And I talk about this a lot. I think I've mentioned it in earlier episodes. But when you meet with parents, one of the questions that I ask pretty frequently is, I wonder how long it's taken for you to get to this point. I wonder how long the process has been where we went from a more ideal state to the state that we're in now. And I'm shocked if it's ever less than several months. So then I typically say, okay, well, it's going to take at least that long for things to start to get better again, because it was a slow fade to where we are, and it will be a slow growth to get back out. And if you set expectations and you make the process clear and known, it just helps everyone understand what's going on and not feel frustrated and not be impatient for things like that. So, Julia, thank you. Your final question is there any place, and I'm assuming you mean when working with children in a child-centered model, is there any place to model or teach coping skills? And if not, can you explain more why not? Well, yes. The short answer to that question is because we don't deviate from the child-centered model. So if we are child-centered therapists, we are child-centered therapists. And we use the child-centered model. We use the child-centered approach that becomes our one and only theoretical orientation. So it's not child-centered play therapy plus anything else. It's child-centered play therapy. Why? Because it's empirically supported, because it is validated, and because it works. And it honors the child and the fact that they know what they struggle with. They know how to heal themselves. They just need the time, the tools, and the opportunity to do so within the context of a therapeutic relationship to serve as guide rails. So we don't ever model or teach coping skills. Why? Because if we follow the model, they will teach themselves. They will learn coping skills on their own. They will learn to regulate on their own. They will learn to handle their issues more effectively on their own. Everything that we do is predicated on the belief that kids know how to heal and they know why they need to heal. So we just provide the environment and the relationship to do so. And so we do not teach coping skills, but that does not mean they won't gain them. That's one of the most common outcomes of play therapy is kids gain coping skills and resilience to handle things more appropriately. But that's done through our use of the four pillars and our rules of thumb and all of the other things that we've already talked about in earlier episodes. So, Julia, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate your question. And remember, we trust the process. Above all, we trust the process. So if ever a child is not staying on a standard pace, if they're not progressing through stages or phases the way we think that they normally would, if it's taking longer, if they're more resistant, if there's any kind of hindrance to their process, we have to fall back on trusting the process of child-centered play therapy no matter what. We trust ourselves, we trust the theoretical model, we trust the child, and we trust that it works. And when we fall back on just trusting it, it naturally unfolds in a positive way. So I'm so grateful for each and every one of you. If you would like to reach out to me, please email me at brenna@thekidcounselor.com. I love hearing from you all. And I'm very, very grateful that you spend a little bit of time with me each week. We'll talk again soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com.